Okay, we're back and zooming in on the final few minutes of our discussion here on bird language and what bird language can teach us. And this side, what we're going to do is link bird language to brain patterning and kind of talk about the 7 attributes of a healthy mind. Before I do that, I just wanted to remind you that other animals seem to have developed what we might call seeing ability or advanced instinctive ability. And the reason I come to this conclusion is because there's been a lot of times when I have seen sharp-shinned hawks cause incredible alarm in the birds around them. And there's other times when I've seen sharp-shinned hawks fly through a landscape and not cause any alarm at all. And I finally figured out over time that the sharp-shinned that wasn't causing alarm was well-fed and wasn't hungry and wasn't hunting. So there's something so subtle in either the body language or in the feelings that that sharp-shinned is giving off that the birds know how to tell the difference between when it's dangerous and when it's not. And that might answer some of your questions, because some of you might assume that a cat walking across the lawn must always be a cat that's going to cause bird alarms, but it's not necessarily true. Sometimes the cat can walk across the lawn and have no bird alarms as a result, and the other time it crosses, it gets attacked feverishly by mockingbirds. The difference being, in one moment it's hunting, in the other it's not. This is illustrated in knowledge of native people. I remember reading one story about coyote. A coyote was sleeping in the field, lazily lounging in the field in the beautiful sunshine, smelling the flowers, hearing the breeze, feeling the good feelings of the earth around it. Waking up from a dream, coyote yawned, looked out across the meadow, and all around coyote were the birds singing and feeding, and nearby was rabbit, who was happily feeding in the grass. Coyote just watched rabbit lazily as he was waking up from his dream. Rabbit was feeding in the grass, and then coyote had a thought. I'm hungry. Rabbit looks awful good. When coyote opened his eyes again and looked, rabbit was gone, and all the birds were quiet. So that message is in there, that it's the thought of coyote that changes everything. It's not coyote that causes the problem, but coyote's thought. There's a good lesson in there for all of us, because part of being a scout is learning to control your thoughts, your intent, your will. So remember, birds don't always just react to species. It's often the body language itself or the intent behind it that causes the bird language in the first place. So I want to, again, just kind of remind us and remember that the whole idea of spirit or the whole idea of instinct is all tied up in what we would have to call advanced awareness. That if you took any two kids and raised them side by side and taught one of them to use their 5 senses in a very intense manner and encouraged that same individual to be free with their imagination, to use their mind's eye, to trust the impressions and feelings they get. And the other child you don't do that with, the child that you teach to be aware is going to develop instinctive abilities, dreaming abilities, will become a spiritual person. So, you know, that seems like a bold claim, but to me, I think in a way, the whole answer to most of the world's problems lies in that right there. You know, that children who are raised with really profound awareness develop tremendous innate wisdom. They also develop great empathy and kindness. So it's beyond just, you know, I think what's very popular in the New Age movement is, you know, having great spiritual experiences, you know, and really valuing that. I think it's firmly grounded in what our senses take in and what our mind's eye focuses on, as very many studies have already proven. The brain patterns that is develops clear wiring around the things that we habitually do. And I like to look at my friend Gary Rikus, who runs the Rikus Center in the San Francisco area, south of San Francisco in California. It's a great mentoring center that works on creative arts skills and sports skills. That's a real neat place that works with a lot of our coyote teaching methods. We train them in the art of mentoring down there, and they employ a lot of these methods to help kids develop sort of a rich spiritual ethic and kindness, you know, that Gary also attributes in the same way to to developing awareness around nature. So we're working to get nature awareness down there too. But Gary says, Michael Jordan, if you want to look at him kind of objectively or coldly, you know, is not a magical human being after all. What he is a collection of brain patterns. You know, that you might say that Michael Jordan's ability on the courts is nothing more than a collection of 167 ball handling techniques that when they're all synthesized, when he's in the zone, when he's in his alpha brain state, are sort of played out as this amazing, superhuman, extraordinary ability. And what Gary was saying, that you could take anybody and teach them 167 ball handling skills, developing each of them individually as a set of brain patterns. So maybe a certain kind of dribbling with the right hand is one of those 167 skills. And if it's practiced enough, it will become intuitive, because what happens is the brain develops wiring, or worn-in places, if you will, that electricity can flow through regularly on a normal sort of background level. So after a while, if you practice it enough, you no longer have to think about it. It just happens intuitively. So if you take all 167 of Michael Jordan's amazing quote-unquote abilities, practice them all to the level where they become that intense, you'll become an amazing basketball player. I mean, you'll almost become like Michael Jordan himself. Of course, you would also have to have his height. So this would be relative, of course, to the height of the hoop in relation to the height of your body. So you'd have to proportionately scale the hoop that way. So I'm saying the same thing applies here with bird language and awareness, that if you develop enough of these same resources, you will evolve, quote unquote, spiritual ability. And that's why I don't like that word, because, you know, it's sort of religions and meditation practices that have made it esoteric and have made it exclusive and have made it special in a way that Native people never thought of it special. They don't call it a religion. They call it, hey, it's not a religion. This is life, man. This is just us. We're not religious about this. We're just doing it, you know? What do you mean religion? We don't even know what you're talking about. They don't even have a word for it. This is just life. You know, this is just living. So, you know, what's the connection? Well, the brain patterns on only two sources, those brain patterns that I'm referring to, there's only two sources from which they emerge in our brain. One of them is what our senses take in, and one of them is what our mind focuses on. So you can think about that for a minute. So let's look at Michael Jordan again for a second. Think about it in that context. What are his senses taking in? You know, it's a three-dimensional experience. The movement of the hands, the feeling of the breeze on your hands, the feeling of the muscles moving against gravity, all that sort of thing is stimulating nerve response, which is causing the brain to fire in a very particular manner. So that's what his senses are taking in. And what his mind is focusing on is succeeding in that event, you know, picturing it in his mind, succeeding in that event. So that's a kind of an easy example for us to integrate into our thought process. Oh yeah, I can get that. That makes sense. Well, think about Western society. You know, it's a whole collection of things that our senses take in and that our mind focuses on. Everything that's modeled, everything that we take in as quote-unquote everyday normal experience creates a whole bunch of people with the same brain patterns. So there's this whole collective, what we would call reality, that everyone buys into. The myth of the emperor with no clothes is the same story as this that I'm describing to you now. All of the people have a collection of brain patterns in common that they have all come to own as real. So when the emperor comes down the street naked and everyone's sort of convinced that he has clothes on, that he's wearing this great new outfit that has been made for him, they all buy into it until one person says, hey, the emperor has no clothes, and there's this great uproar. People who practice scout skills in the modern world are very similar to the person in that story who says the emperor has no clothes, because they are patterned outside of what is considered normal reality. And it doesn't mean that they're developing these amazing spiritual strange things. Nothing's coming from another planet to influence them. They're essentially just developing brain patterns that other people don't bother to develop anymore. So they develop these powerful instinctive abilities, which are seen as an anomaly or seen as a special gift, when really all they are is natural patterns that native people have for millions of years, probably evolved quite naturally, simply from paying attention to their environment in a certain way. And that certain way is using the ears with a great focus on problem solving. So it's not just like waiting for someone to call your name and saying, yeah, or listening in a conversation to a stream of words. It's listening in three dimensions, listening above you, listening all around you, and listening in ever-increasing layers of subtlety, the loud sounds near you, and the layers of sounds behind that, and the layers of sound behind that, that are always coming at you in three dimensions from the forest or the wild places. If you just walk through the woods once, you may perceive those three dimensions of sounds, but then again, you may not. You may not have the brain patterns in order to perceive those sounds, if you know what I mean. Just like the first time you handle a basketball, you see someone dribble a basketball with great ability, and all of a sudden you say, oh, that looks so easy, I think I'll do that, and you go and try and do it, but you can't do it. You feel like you're using your elbows, you know, that, and you can't do it. And the reason you can't is because you don't have any brain patterns. In the same way, your perception works exactly the same. If you go out in the forest and you've never listened before, you don't have the brain patterns necessary to recognize bird sounds, to discern in three dimensions. You might hear wind blowing, but to you it might sound like one solid wall of sound. But someone who goes out all the time will begin to hear that the wind has a shape and that it has texture and that there's depth to it and dimensionality to it and qualities that are very, very complex and almost impossible to describe in words. That's from brain patterning. So if you think about hearing in that manner, and then add to that the layer of problem solving, as we talked about with the wolf, that bird language in three dimensions adds yet another depth and element of brain patterning that causes the brain to develop more wiring still. So in patterning our brain, our eyesight, our hearing, our sense of smell, our skin, and then focusing our minds on the sacred silence and using thankfulness as our focus, okay, we're focusing our brain in a very particular way, and we're using our senses in a very particular way, and our brain is patterning in a very particular way. I have to ask this question. What do you think is more natural for our brain? Patterning in the manner that I just described, the patterning of a scout's awareness or a native's awareness, or patterning on ball handling drills? Which is going to come easier? You know? Which one are we born to do? So let's look at children for a second for that answer. If you look at children all over the world, they automatically do certain things all over the world, automatically, without being prompted. One example of that is na 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 na. It's a built-in brain pattern, rhythm and melody with a certain feeling to it. Even the chiding, you know, they even use it in the same context. That's already built in there. Hide and seek is already built in there. Sneaking up on things is built in there. Imitating things, making forts, playing in the mud, that's all built in. Children do that automatically without being told. So what that tells you is that the brain already possesses that software. It's already in there. And it's kind of like raw material. It's almost like you're given an almost carved statue. Right? And when you use your senses, the rest of that statue is carved in intricate detail. And the more detail you experience in the environment, and the more you get there, the more you spend time at your secret spot, and the more intensity you use when you're listening, the more detailed the carving becomes. So that's sort of a reflection of how our brain evolves. So if you look at all the things that children have in common that they naturally do, and you combine them with sensory training in the context of the language of birds and tracking, and you focus your mind on Thanksgiving and the sacred silence, you'll evolve a very sophisticated and natural brain pattern array, which opens up your antenna to experience what we would call paranormal response, which I can't stand that name for it, you know, that idea of spirituality or mystical experience or vision or paranormal response makes it sound like somehow it's beyond normal. You know, I don't like that feeling because to me, this is just life. You know, this is just a human being developing in a natural way. So having said that, I would like to kind of talk specifically about what we call the seven symptoms of awareness, the seven symptoms of natural brain patterning. There's a word that when you translate it from Lakota to English, it's interpreted two different ways. There is a kind of context to the language, the Lakota language, that has changed through time because the Lakota people have changed. If you go back a couple hundred years, you have a whole bunch of people living as hunter-gatherers whose whole definition of the world is different from people who have grown up in houses and buildings today who still speak that same language. The language has changed meaning because their brain patterns have changed. Their reality, their shared common belief system has changed. And there's a word that's translated roughly today, ikchewachasha, which means the common man or the common person, that has an entirely different contextual meaning if you talk to some elderlies who can remember back to the time when the language was reflective of a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. So if you look at that word, even in the context of how it's used in songs and ceremony, it means something totally different today than it meant a couple hundred years ago. And Gilbert was reflecting on that with me because I pressed him. You know, Gilbert, I don't really quite understand the way this word, ikchewachasha, is being used in this song. It seems to be saying something different than common person. He says, well, yeah, they translate it today to mean common person. He says, but if you look back in time, it meant something totally different because what they called the common person just a couple hundred years ago or 150 years ago, those people, all of the people, were not knowledgeable of their landscape. They were all scouts. They had all developed this really intense brain patterning. They were all totally linked and empathetic and aware and spiritually connected to every aspect of their natural environment. Because the song says, the common person, their way is sacred. So what it's referring to is that the spirit that moves in all things, the essence of sacred life, of sacred belief, the spirit that moves in all things, or what they would call, you know, Wakantanka, the great spirit, the great energy that's moving everywhere, is part of sacred awareness, right? But being a human being connected to nature will bring you to a sacred state of mind. It doesn't say that the common person walking down the street in 1999 is sacred. You know, everything really in the universe is imbued with sacred powers. That's certain, for sure, especially in that belief system. But what it's saying is that the people who lived in the natural way evolved a sacred awareness. That the common person is sacred. So when we think about the context, the meaning of the word, you know, what the East represents, the spirit of the East in the same context, they talk about the knowledge of human beings, the knowledge of mankind. If we look again in a modern context, the knowledge of mankind, right away what people are going to think when they hear that is all of our math, all of our science, all of our technological ability, everything that we know, all of the dirty jokes we know, all of the recipes, all of that mixes together to create the knowledge of mankind. You'll get a totally skewed view of what that's really saying. The concept that comes with the pre-dawn chorus, the concept of the knowledge from the East, is again referring to the knowledge of the ancestors who were connected to nature in the full-bodied way that I've been describing on this whole tape series. That knowledge of mankind in the context of total nature awareness, total focus on thankfulness, total living in the sacred silence is an entirely different reality state than the knowledge of mankind 1999 Western point of view. Does that make sense to you? So when we think about the knowledge of human beings, in the context of native awareness, we're talking about a brain that has been patterned in the most natural way possible. It's referring to a state of awareness and an ability to transcend mundane reality that's totally and utterly linked to simple brain patterning on the natural environment around you. That it's not necessarily a mystical or religious practice. But native religion evolved ways to speed up the process. Does that make sense? You know, Tom Brown points it out in Field Guide to Nature Observation and Tracking. he talks about the sweat lodge as a doorway to increase the speed with which you develop your sacred silence ability, your ability to be aware. So a lot of these native traditions and songs and ceremonies and spiritual ways were ways in which the elders figured out over time and through spiritual guidance and through visions and dreams, they evolved a system that allowed them to speed up the process by which their youth became really, really aware, so that they had a better quality leadership, a more empathetic person in the tribe. So that's the original context of these things. They helped the people to live. And a lot of the songs and prayers even say that. I just want to live to the fullness of my days. You know? So also we remember in brain patterning and awareness that in the hunter-gatherer societies of Australia, it is often the trackers who, in their older years, become the medicine society leaders, the ceremonial leaders, the spiritual practitioners, the healers. In the Pacific Northwest, the storytellers are the ones who become that. Because storytelling is not a whole lot different from tracking in the way that it patterns the brain. But remember, these storytellers were not just storytellers. They were storytellers who lived off the land, who had that context of nature awareness training. So what are the seven symptoms of natural brain patterning? Well, the first one we've talked about quite a bit already, what Gilbert would talk about as quietness, or the sacred silence, as Grandfather Stalking Wolf would say. The second symptom of this is the happiness of a child. And that's referring not only to what children do naturally, but it also says that when we practice tracking and we practice awareness in this manner in a habitual way, we rediscover our childhood and we rediscover the happiness of what it feels like to be a child. I remember Jen Jacobson telling me that tracking was the fountain of youth. Remember, Jen? That's what I remember when she reached that profile, and she was just like, oh, it's just like being a kid again. And exactly what it's like. You know, the happiness of a child is a symptom that your brain is evolving in a natural way. Third one, and by the way, these are not necessarily in any kind of order. You know, don't think of them as sort of symbolic of, you know, when they happen. It's just all seven of them together is a good sign, you know. The third one is developing the quickness, the health and quickness of a wolf or a coyote, where reflexes are amazing. Your ability to change positions and to react in the moment and to make decisive moves that are very effective. You know, it's not just health, but it's this incredible vital health in the moment that allows you to escape danger or to respond quickly or to answer with a really funny line when someone says something that begs to be chided on. Right? The quickness of a wolf. And to be truly helpful is the fourth one. To actually develop an awareness of yourself to the point where you really understand what your greatest contribution is to the world around you. You understand why you were put on this earth, so to speak. You know yourself well enough to know your gifts, your passions, and the things that you can really offer the world around you. So to know yourself truly well is to also know how to be truly helpful. And you also desire, because of your intense empathy and your intense ability to observe and see patterns, you can see where danger is happening just before it happens, and you can be truly helpful by stepping in and intervening, protecting a child from a danger, helping an elderly across the way, or bringing them firewood because you have a flash of intuition that says, oh, I know it's cold this morning, and I can remember that so-and-so can't get wood, so I'll just run up there and see if they need firewood, and sure enough, they do. You know, that's becoming truly helpful. You know, how do I fit in? A very, very important symptom of this whole thing is the fifth one, which I've mentioned before in this tape. I didn't point it out in this manner, but it's the whole idea that you develop enough brain patterning, enough empathy, enough appreciation for the things around you, where you begin to see the sacred in everything. You begin to see that the Creator's love is truly in every single thing around you. You develop this enormous compassion, this Christ-like or Gandhian love for all things around you, even those things that seem to be a threat or your enemy, you know. You see the Creator's love in all things. A sixth symptom is that you carry certain things in your heart you carry the love of your children, of your loved ones, your family. You carry that in your heart like an awareness. It's always with you. But you also carry in your heart the love of the beauty of sunrise, maybe, or the love of birdsong, or the love of the fox or the coyote, or something that calls your attention in a special way. We all have things in the environment that call to each of us individually. Each of us has different things that we're drawn to, but you walk around with an awareness and an appreciation of these things within you all the time. It's true thankfulness. It's mastering that concept of Thanksgiving, address, you know, the idea that if you give thanks every day, every morning, before you head out to your secret spot, or when you get there, you repeat the Thanksgiving words to yourself, you'll eventually develop sort of great appreciation for all things that you carry in your heart. It's always with you. So true thankfulness. And this last one, which is, as I said, they're not in any kind of order. The last one is one of my favorite ones, and that is the feeling that you've come alive. You know, and I see this a lot in those people that we mentor, especially in that high school that we run, the community school. These kids come alive. They literally live in the moment, and they have so much fun. They laugh harder than anybody I know. They play harder than anybody I know. And it's totally reminiscent of all the times I've spent with Tom growing up and the times that I spent with my own children growing up and the people that I've mentored over the years where we play with reckless abandon. You know, it's like, you know, we see the mud, we're all swimming in it in 5 minutes, you know, the mud fights that go on, the chiding and the joking and the uproarious laughter and singing with great spirit and dancing with great spirit coming out of our bodies and minds and hearts, you know, truly appreciating every moment and just reaching in there and grabbing that moment and squeezing it for everything it's got, as if it's your last moment. You know, the concept of to come alive, you know, it's a beautiful thing. These seven symptoms of natural brain patterning seem to happen more quickly when people practice ceremony like the Anipi or the Sweat Lodge tradition, you know, and that's where this knowledge comes from. Gilbert talks about these seven symptoms of sort of the sacred attributes of life that the elders watch for from those who attend ceremony on a regular basis. But an important thing to remember, you know, it's absolutely vital for us to remember that these symptoms themselves and the ceremony itself should not, could not, will not exist in the absence of awareness skills. You know, something to remember. As the years have gone by in my 16 years of mentoring and my 20 plus years of involvement with ceremonies like the Sweat Lodge or the Anipi ceremony, and having gotten to know these communities pretty well, I have definitely observed that the people who have a lot of secret spot time, who have a lot of awareness skills, tracking skills, who spend a lot of time in solitude in nature, are also the same people who have the greatest spiritual results from the lodge experience itself. And that harkens back to something that, you know, Tom Brown reminded me of not too long ago. He was saying something about Stalking Wolf's search for these universal truths. You know, in a way, what we might say is that Stalking Wolf was searching for what are the things that pattern our brain in a universal fashion. You know, what are these things that are common to all human beings worldwide that cause us to develop into good humans with a lot of awareness and caretaking ability? And not just caretaking ability, but the internal desire to caretake, you know, not just sort of be forced into it by environmental laws and regulations. You know, when does it become a natural process for a human being to truly caretake for the future generations? And, you know, Stalking Wolf observed that ceremony was certainly part of that. You know, practicing common experience together in celebration and thanksgiving. But that, he said, ceremony without awareness was only half a circle. That awareness without thanksgiving, without prayer, without ceremony was only half a circle. So that you could only get so far if all you practiced was awareness skills, or you could only get so far if all you practiced was physical skills. And you could only get so far if all you did was ceremony and attend religious experience. But that when you take awareness and the practice of awareness in its highest forms and put it together with ceremony in its highest forms, what you get is a complete circle. And that's a powerful thing, and it's the most powerful experience for a human being when both of those things come together in one place. So, again, reminding us that awareness is the most important physical skill in Stalking Wolf's estimation, and that tracking and bird language as a form of tracking are the highest expressions of this. Okay, so that we remember that Thanksgiving must be part of it, that Thanksgiving is a ceremony in and of itself. It's the simplest of all ceremonies. You know, the words, thank you. It's the simplest of ceremonies. I recognize what I see around me, I appreciate it, and I express my thanks to the unseen world around me that I know exists. How do I know it exists? Because my instincts are unexplainable. You know, the native people didn't need to be taught religion because they saw that their instincts worked. Their dreams came true. They saw things before they happened. They had an intuition that somebody they knew was in danger, and they ran to them and they found that they indeed were in danger. So they, just being pragmatic people, made the observation, something else is working here behind the scenes that's pulling it all together. I can't ignore it, you know? And we can look at it as Westerners and say, well, that's crazy, they're superstitious. But from their point of view, this is everyday life. They're seeing it all around them. How could they deny it? So they said, thank you. We don't know what you are. In fact, a lot of, you know, the translation of a lot of words for God or spirit from native language is simply the unseen, the magical, the mysterious, the great unknown, right? Or the creator, the spirit that moves in all things. They don't pretend to know what it is. They just know it exists, and they're thankful for it, because they also notice that the more they're thankful for it, the better their lives become. So they also make that pragmatic observation. It's not superstition. And you wouldn't even call it religion in their context. They're just pragmatic people. I know when I'm thankful, things get better. Quite simple, you know? I know that when I hunt with this bow and this arrow, I'm better at killing things than I am when I use this rock. You know, it's just a pragmatic response. You know, so that's why I say I tend to shy away from the concept of religion or spirit, you know, as something separate from natural experience. So in this last remaining time, you know, I'll just bring in a few other practices that Wilderness Awareness School has used over the years that we call the Six Shields of Awareness. And, you know, if someone asked me what's the shortest distance between Western experience and really intense awareness at the level that I'm describing to you here, what is the shortest distance between those two points? And over the years, I've had the opportunity, the great honor, to observe lots of people practicing their skills. And I have definitely seen trends. From those trends, I evolved this, what we call six shields of awareness, which are really six different curriculums, six different sets of activities and routines and practices and ways to learn that help people get to what we call the central fire, which is that place within us that is the sacred silence, that place where we feel truly that we know ourselves, to that place where we have those seven symptoms going, at least some of the time every day. Not all the time, because what I notice about those seven symptoms, when you live in a modern life, oftentimes you have to compromise between fully experiencing those seven and having to deal with what's necessary in order to pay your bills. So, you know, don't feel bad if it happens to you. You're not alone. You know, we all have to make that compromise on a daily basis. But one thing I will say on behalf of these practices is that the nice thing about them is they don't cost anything, you know. It's cheap entertainment, and it's extremely valuable entertainment, because as you develop these skills, the richness of your life increases dramatically. We look at the east shield of our school. We call it the Kamana Shield, and the Kamana Naturalist Training Program handles all those pieces really nicely. But if you weren't in our independent study program, you didn't feel like doing it, you couldn't afford it, or you just said, I don't need those guys, I can do it myself, basically what it involves is daily secret spot practice and daily observation based on what you see on the earth every day, what you see in the waters, the life form of the waters, the plants, the trees, the animals, the birds, the sky, the moon, the sun, the clouds, the wind patterns, the stars, you know, just kind of watching and checking on that and journaling about it every day. And at the same time, developing your five senses through a series of exercises and practices that you could get yourself out of Tom Brown's Field Guide to Nature Observation and Tracking, and combining that with daily research, learning how to be really effective at answering your own questions about plants and animals, trees and birds, etc., through a journaling process. So that's what we call the Kamana Naturalist Training Program, and the idea of that is to ground a person, give them a really solid basic foundation in their local environment, you know, and help them just kind of do it on their own. And we also have what we call the South Shield of our school, which is what we call the Shikari Tracking Program, which is based very much on the way that Tom taught me to track, and just takes off from where the Kamana program leaves off, and helps you to learn basically how to identify tracks and how to identify sign, how to read tracks for the nuances of behavior, how to age tracks and sign, that is, tell when they took place, how to put it in the context of the local landscape, how to link it with everything around you, how to follow animals when you can't seem to see their tracks, and eventually how to evolve sort of enough empathy to see through the animal's eyes. It's a collection of techniques and methods that, you know, are tried and true, the way that Tom trained me, that build on and wrap around the things that Tom teaches at his school and through his books and writings. So that's the Shikari Tracker Training Program. People who do both the East and the South Shield of our school develop these resources, these quote-unquote spiritual resources, much quicker than those who don't. It's pretty simple. I think it's just systematic brain patterning. The Southwest Shield of our school is all about what we call the wanderer, the Imsafiri spirit, which is learning advanced knowledge of plants and how to use them, how to work on understanding your own body's basic health systems from a traditional native standpoint. Basically, learning how to wander freely and feel good about that, and evolving appreciation for the caretaker spirit, how to look after the land, how to kind of follow the methods of someone like Merv Wilkinson to become a powerful gardener in the context of your landscape so that you can leave a really good ecological footprint, to quote Jim Merkel, who also embodies these same values and spirit principles, and make sure that the place is better for the future generations than the way we found it. So it's the ultimate nurturer, the ultimate nurturing model. And then our West Shield training, our West Shield teachings, are the things that help us to learn to be good coyote teachers, good leaders, good team players, help us to kind of evolve understanding of this complex system of brain patterning and how it works in the next generation, and how to create and construct effective three-dimensional cultural experiences for our students that we're mentoring, so that we simulate the hunter-gatherer nomadic society and create the need that we're talking about. And then our North Shield in our school is all about understanding what it takes to truly live off the land in the wintertime. We call that the Tomwea Shield, in honor of the great scout traditions of the Lakota people, really modeling off of Grandfather Stalking Wolf's ability to master every physical skill there is, from fire to shelter to clothing to buckskin, to be able to do all that stuff on your own and to head out into the wilderness and to actually live. That's a very advanced shield, and, you know, it's not exactly the people pounding down the door to actually experience it. They like to practice the early levels of it just to know that they could survive if they had to, but very few people want to practice it to the high degree that Stalking Wolf mastered it or that Tom did. So that's the Tonwaya shield. It's also about developing intense knowledge of yourself so that you can overcome obstacles by using what we call Wolverine medicine, the ability to power through things, using a powerful mind, to overcome all obstacles. Our sixth shield is the one that we just journeyed in for the last six tapes. The last 12 sides of tape is the Dawa shield, and it's all about the linking of your awareness routines, your bird language knowledge, your develop of empathy and instinct, and how it relates to brain patterning and eventually spiritual development, and eventually how to conduct yourself in the context of what we would call ceremony. Because there are ways that have evolved over the years for thousands, if not millions of years, among Native people that seem to be similar worldwide. You know, what are the basic ingredients of a appreciative, ceremonial, cohesive culture? How does it work? What are the things that people all do and have in common? And how does that link to brain patterning and awareness? What are the universal elements that make us all the same as human beings? What are the things that help us to overcome grief and troubles in our lives and help us to develop what we would call real power in our paths? How do we become truly helpful? How do we develop those seven symptoms? That's what the Dawa Shield is all about. It's highly linked to what we call animal forms, which is, you know, like Bakwa in Tai Chi, an internal art form that's based on movement that imitates the sacred dances of native people. But since we, a lot of us as Westerners, no longer have access to sacred dance and how to do it, we've evolved a whole way to rekindle that so we can create our own sacred dance based on our observations of animals. And we practice a lot of creative art forms in that, developing a strong mind's eye, help moving our bodies in the same way that Tai Chi teaches as an internal martial art. And it's mostly based around what Tom Brown called the Apache Wolverine fighting methods, which are methods by which we imitate animals to gain their strength. So this is very similar to sacred dance all over the world. So that's what it's about. Practicing, essentially, giving us an excuse to always use our owl vision, always use our fox walking, become highly aware of our bodies and our minds. So that is the six shields of awareness, as Wilderness Awareness School uses them as a teaching culture to benefit the next generations. And this is what we learn from the birds. If you collect all these 12 sides of this tape together, they just more or less say the same thing, which I'm going to end with, which is, why don't you go out and go to your secret spot now? Get out to your secret spot. Learn to move slowly with a lot of awareness, pay attention, and reflect a lot and journal a lot. And, you know, just basically pay attention. You know, have an excuse to be in the present moment, to have a lot of quality in your awareness, not necessarily quantity and experience, and to just see how it adds up over time. And that concludes all that I have to say about the bird language. Advanced Bird Language, Reading the Concentric Rings of Nature, is concluding now, and I just would like to end by, again, thanking the ancestors for sharing this knowledge and keeping it alive long enough for us to gather around and listen to it and learn from it, and also to thank the birds and the animals and the natural world around us for the profound gifts that they give to our awareness and for actually being responsible for us to learn how to be good human beings again. Well, at this point, too, I guess it's good for us to know that what we've gathered to study and celebrate together, we've achieved that long list of things. So now it's good for us to go away from this session, go away from this tape, and separate our minds from this knowledge so we can go back to living our lives in the present. As Yoda says, we must live in the present.
To www.natureoutlet.com for information on John Young and Wilderness Awareness School's classes, expeditions, tapes, home study courses, and intensive mentoring opportunities. Thank you for listening.